Right now, though, it's 8:30, and that means it's time for the Law Report. Damien Carrick, good morning.
Good morning, Fran.
And Damien, this morning you're looking at new research on how impressionable we are in the jury box.
Yes, the dangers of priming. It seems that sometimes we hear what we are told to hear. Now, getting the wrong end of the stick is bad enough in everyday life. But if you're sitting on a jury and you're told by an expert that a scratchy piece of audio evidence contains certain words, that can have huge implications on what you hear and on the outcome for an accused. Dr. Helen Fraser is a phonetics expert, currently an independent researcher. She's had 20 years' experience in the university sector. Together with Dr. Bruce Stevenson and Dr. Tony Marks, who are both psycholinguists at the University of New England, the trio will be publishing some very interesting research in the next edition of the International Journal of Speech, Language and the Law. Their research centres around a highly controversial piece of audio that prosecutors in New Zealand desperately wanted to put before a jury. It was only after a lengthy court battle that the defence succeeded in squashing the idea. I should warn that the audio that you'll hear is a real call to a New Zealand emergency call centre made back in 1994. It may disturb some listeners. Here's Helen Fraser.
Well, Damien, your listeners are probably familiar with the idea that police and other bodies sometimes use covert recordings that could be from a telephone intercept or from bugging somebody's house, for example. And then we have some audio that could be called a forensic recording because it's going to be used as evidence in a legal case. And something that goes along with recordings is making a transcript of what is said in the recording. So forensic transcription is all about transcribing that kind of covert recording that's used as evidence in a legal case.
And Helen Fraser, you've done some very, very interesting research which centres on how we hear this sort of audio and how it is actually ends up being transcribed or processed or brought into court as evidence. Tell me about that research.
Yeah, well, we were very lucky in that some audio that was used in an actual legal case in New Zealand came into the public domain. So it became easy to use it for an experiment, and that's what this experiment is about. It's taking some audio that was used in a real legal case, and that there was a dispute over whether it was saying one thing or another thing. And I'm able now to create an experiment presenting that audio to a group of participants and seeing how they respond to it under different conditions.
Let's listen to some of that audio. I should warn listeners that this is a very disturbing piece of audio. It's part of a call made back in 1994 by David Bain to a crisis call centre. He's calling them to tell them that he has arrived home to find his father, his mother, his two sisters and his brother murdered.
I just can help you.
They're all, yeah. They're all dead.
What's the matter?
They're all dead. I came home and they're all dead.
Whereabouts are you?
Every street.
Or every street.
65 every street. They're all dead.
Who's all dead?
My family, they're all dead. Hurry up.
It's okay. Every street that runs off Somerville Street?
Yes.
Now what phone number are you calling from?
454.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Damien, as you can hear, it sounds very much as if he had just come home and found his family were all dead. But in fact, a few days after he made that call, he was actually accused of their murder. And sometime later, in fact, several years later, there was a lot of intervening time, it was alleged by the prosecution that the telephone call itself actually contained a confession by the caller to the murder.
So what was the nature of your experiment? I understand that you divided 190 people into two groups and then you played them the audio with different sets of information given to both groups. Tell me what you did.
Well, Damien, your listeners might be wondering at the moment, where on earth was there a confession to murder in that long crisis call that we just heard? It sounded as if he was talking, you know, they're all dead, hurry up, giving his address, giving his phone number. But in fact, there was a tiny piece of speech in there, or at least a tiny, we've just been calling it the section of interest, because some people don't even think it was speech, but there was a section of interest in there which was alleged to contain this confession to murder.
Let's listen to that smaller piece of audio which contains the contested voice or noise.
So what I did was, yes, I got 190 participants from all around the world. We delivered it online, so we were able to get quite a lot of participants from all over the place. And we basically played them the audio, first the call and then the section of interest. And we invited them to imagine that they were on the jury as evidence about the case was unfolded to them piece by piece. And after each piece of evidence, we asked them, what do you hear in the section of interest? So at the beginning, a lot of people thought that it was not speech at all or uninterpretable speech. And quite a lot of people thought it was the words, I can't breathe.
As I understand it, what you do is you put to one group, one of the two groups, what the prosecution believes was in that segment of audio, which was, I think, the words, I shot the prick. Is that right?
Exactly. The group A that got this story that was roughly similar to the actual Bain case said that the alleged confession that can be heard in that little section that we just listened to was the words, I shot the prick.
Let's just hear that audio again. Yeah, and now that I've been primed, I can certainly hear it.
At that point, 30% of people confidently heard, I shot the prick.
What conclusions do you draw from the results of your experiment?
Well, I'll just tell you what they did after hearing the full story. So far I've explained that in our group where we fed them the idea that he said, I shot the prick, about 30% of people confidently heard, I shot the prick, as soon as that was suggested to them.
Up from nothing.
Although nobody had ever heard it before. After we said the full story, and we said, rather than just having a phonetics expert coming on and saying it's very unlikely that he really said, I shot the prick, once we had the full story saying that it was generally agreed that he did not say that and that he'd been exonerated, a lot of people went back to their original idea that he'd said either uninterpretable speech, not speech at all, or I can't breathe. But half of the people, half of the 30%, in fact, the final number I think was 17% from that group, still believed he had said I shot the prick, even though they'd been told that it really had been found not to be the case that that was what he had said.
Helen Fraser, what do you take home from this research about the way forensic transcription should be used in our courts?
Well, the first most important thing is that transcriptions should not be left to the jury to evaluate. In most cases, it is possible to evaluate transcripts of forensic recordings, the kinds of recordings that are used as evidence in a case, especially from a covert listening device. It's possible to evaluate transcripts like that before it's ever presented to the court at all, let alone to the jury. And wherever that's possible, that should be done. If it does have to be left to the jury, for some reason, if there's a dispute between experts on both sides, which cannot be easily resolved outside court, then of course it has to be taken to the court. It becomes a legal matter. But then that should be presented to the jury very, very carefully.
Phonetics expert Dr. Helen Fraser. Back in 1994, David Bain was 22 years old and living with his parents in Dunedin. On the 20th of June 1994, he came home from his morning paper round to find his family murdered. He was charged with the crime. At his trial, the crisis call was played to the jury, but there was no suggestion that it contained a confession. On other evidence, David Bain was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. At this point, Joe Karam, a former player with the New Zealand All Blacks and now successful businessman, championed David Bain's fight to clear his name. Joe Karam explains how the audio was initially used.
Yes, it was played twice to them.
But there was no question during that trial that this audio contained a confession.
When they got the tape, they did a transcript of the tape, and the transcript was presented to the jury as an exhibit, and the jury listened to the tape two or three times, and there was absolutely nothing suspicious on the tape whatsoever, no.
In this trial, David Bain was actually found guilty. I understand that with your help, essentially, he went to court three times to appeal this conviction. He eventually went all the way to the Privy Council in the UK, who found, in May 2007, that a substantial miscarriage of justice had occurred. They quashed the conviction, but it left open the possibility for a retrial. In brief terms, what were those miscarriages of justice that the Privy Council found?
Well, there were nine of the most... Virtually all of the evidence against David Bain was found to be suspect. The Privy Council, I can't remember the precise words, but said that for the sake of their decision, they would concentrate on nine major points of evidence. These related to everything from fingerprints to alibi evidence and so on, all of which were put to the jury at David's trial in a way that was either incomplete, totally wrong, or otherwise misleading.
Joe Karam. Among other things, the Privy Council was concerned that forensic evidence suggesting that David Bain's father killed himself after first killing his family was never put to the jury. And neither was evidence that David Bain's sister had planned that week to confront her parents about child sexual abuse she claimed she had endured at the hands of her father. You might think the Privy Council's ruling in May 2007 would be where this saga ended. But at that point, New Zealand authorities decided to prosecute David Bain again. And at this point, 13 years after the murders, prosecutors decided for the first time that the crisis call was important, indeed crucial evidence. Linguist Bronwyn Innes is an honorary research fellow at the University of Auckland.
Once the Privy Council had quashed the conviction, the police took that recording to be digitised so it could be analysed, replayed on modern equipment. And during that process, a policeman thought that he heard certain words on the recording, which nobody had ever heard before.
And they thought there was a confession. They thought there was a confession in that audio.
That's right. There was a section of the audio that had heavy breathing and some sounds that occur in language as part of that heavy breathing. The police believed that David Bain had said, "I shot the prick."
So they wanted to introduce that as evidence into the upcoming jury trial. I understand that that was contested by the defence, and this became a huge legal saga, which I think went through three levels of courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court. What did they ultimately decide?
Ultimately, the Supreme Court decided that that portion of the recording was not relevant, and therefore it was excised and not played to the jury.
Now, you were intimately involved in this process because I understand you were called as an expert witness or analyst of this audio. What was your expert advice?
The defence contacted me and asked me to prepare a transcript of the recording.
And when you heard and when you analysed this disputed piece of audio, did you hear the confession?
I did not.
And you gave that as evidence in court?
Yes, I did.
And so ultimately this went all the way up to the Supreme Court of New Zealand, the highest court in the land, and they decided that this contested piece of audio shouldn't be put to the jury. What was their reasoning?
Basically they said it was irrelevant because it couldn't prove anything. The difficulty with it was that there wasn't evidence in the recording that those words had been said. There wasn't enough evidence. So there was no way of determining whether he'd really said anything or not. As I said, I didn't think words were spoken, and the other linguists felt that it was impossible to determine that as well. In addition, the sounds weren't exactly right for what the police had said, but I didn't in fact give evidence on that point because I wasn't taken past the idea of whether there were words there or not. So the Supreme Court said because the linguists couldn't be sure that words were spoken, let alone what they were, that therefore it couldn't be taken to prove anything. So therefore it wasn't relevant.
Was the idea that this information, if it was put to a jury, would be very prejudicial?
That would have been extremely prejudicial, yes.
So the probative value, they couldn't establish that there was, if you like, a lot of probative value in the information on the one hand, and on the other hand, if you did put it towards a jury, it would be extremely prejudicial.
Yes.
Now, of course, after this part of the dispute was settled, David Bain went on to have this second trial without this alleged confession put to the jury. And what happened then?
He was acquitted.
He was found not guilty.
Indeed.
Bronwyn Innes. In June 2009, 15 years after the murder of his family, David Bain was finally cleared. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast each week on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. The program's also available for download at our website, abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. Of course, if the prosecution had put the alleged confession to the jury, things might have turned out differently for David Bain. While New Zealand police were adamant that the audio contained a confession, even their own expert witness was dubious. Peter French runs the UK's longest established independent forensic laboratory, specialising in the analysis of speech, audio and language. He's provided expert evidence in many cases, including David Bain's, where audio evidence is in dispute.
So my conclusion was, not only could we not say that it was "I shot the prick," we couldn't in fact say it was speech at all, because Mr. Bain was obviously very distressed during the call. He was breathing very, very heavily, and at various points in the call he was breathing in such a way that with a little bit of imagination you could have imagined that those breaths were in fact speech. And I wasn't even able to conclude that it was speech at all. It could have just been breaths that happened to sound like "I shot the fish," just through random modification of the airflow with his lips, with his articulation organs.
So presumably New Zealand police were very disappointed with your analysis.
They didn't express their disappointment to me. It's really one of the hazards of getting an expert involved with analysing forensic material of any kind. That the position, as you well know it and I well know it, is that the responsibility of the expert is not to the instructing party, but it's to the court to help the court come to as fair a decision as possible. It's simply a function of the adversarial system of justice that one side or the other has to set the ball rolling and list the expert and pay the bill, but in fact the expert must maintain stalwartly independent and fair to the interests of justice rather than to the interests of their principal.
Peter French, you've been involved in many court cases in the UK where there has been a dispute over audio evidence. Several have involved people from minority groups who speak English with an accent different from the mainstream. Can you tell me about some of those cases? They're very interesting.
Yeah, these are normally called disputed utterance cases. It's where not a transcript as a whole is at issue between prosecution and defence. It's normally just one utterance. It could be a single word. And in fact, I've probably been involved in maybe upwards of 50 or 100 of these in the last 25 years or so. And as you say, yes, sometimes they involve minority accents. I mean, one very well-known one that I acted in involved a murder which took place on a train. The suspect was arrested and he was put in a police holding cell. He was allowed to have a visit from his girlfriend and the cell was bugged. The police recorded the conversation, I think in the hope of getting a recorded confession. They brought the recording to me together with a transcript and it was all down to one utterance, which they felt very strongly showed the guilt of the man. What he said in a West Indian accent was, "All I know is right, I got on the train right, and I shot a man to kill." In other words, I shot a man with the intention of killing him. When I analysed that utterance in detail and compared it with other clear material from other areas of the recording, what in fact he said was, "All I know is right, I got on the train right, I shot a man to kill it." In other words, he'd show the ticket collector his ticket, as he should have done when he boarded the train. So in fact, that was an instance of one where it came out as what was seemingly a confession was in fact a very benign utterance with no evidential value at all. There are others. The very first one I got involved with involved a Greek doctor who was known among the drug community to give out prescriptions in return for cash, prescriptions for controlled drugs. What happened was he prescribed rather a lot of a certain tablet, dihydrocodeine, and this was taken by an addict who overdosed on it and died. The girlfriend went to the police, and for reasons I don't quite understand, either couldn't or wouldn't act against the doctor. So a broadcasting company, television company, put in an actor posing as a drug addict, wired up the sound, who went to visit the doctor. The doctor, in fact, gave him some advice as well as some tablets, which was, in a Greek accent of English, you can inject those things, you know. You can inject those things, you know. And the issue was the word, the second word in the sentence, can or can't. Because in Greek, there isn't a distinction between a and are, and that carries over into his pronunciation of English. And what I had to do was, in fact, find lots of other words which had a in, other words which had the r vowel in, and to do a comparative analysis. And in fact, that came out as can't, you can't inject those things, you know. So it sounded as though the doctor was giving the patient quite improper advice, telling him to in fact grind up tablets and inject them into his veins, when in fact he was giving them a warning, don't inject them. That evidence figured in his disciplinary hearing with the General Medical Council.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because how we hear something depends on the preconceptions that we have.
Very much so. I mean, another example which would also bear on it, and this brings out the preconceptions very much, a couple of gay lovers in a room one afternoon in a flat, one dies, post-mortem examination, results are somewhat ambiguous, whether or not any strangulation has occurred, or whether he died from natural causes. The police interview the lover. The lover maintained stalwartly that no sadomasochistic activity, in fact no sexual activity of any sort, took place that afternoon. Interview him for a long time, all on tape. Eventually they say to him, tell us again just how this happened. And he says, well, he was just sleeping away on the bed, and this is in an Indian accent of English, after wank off, and next thing I knew, he was dead. So it looked as though he was in fact saying sexual activity did take place, there'd been some sort of masturbation going on. And in fact, again, when I analysed that, it wasn't my cough, it was after one cough. So, you know, quite a serious point there, that your preconceptions, what you want to hear, is often what you do hear. And this is something we must be very, very careful about in the analysis of forensic recordings, of course, where justice hangs in the balance, and sometimes this sort of evidence can tip it one way or another, so great caution must be exercised.
UK phonetics expert Peter French. Helen Fraser is another expert who regularly gives evidence in court.
One of the early forensic transcription cases that I was involved in was where there had been a long-running dispute about, based on recordings made from within a household where people were allegedly carrying on a drug dealing business. And in those cases, a lot of the audio is very difficult to hear. People move around the house and the television's on, and you know, all sorts of things make it difficult to hear. And there were some sections, very short sections within that recording, where it was alleged that the person had said the word heroin. And they'd had lots and lots of expert evidence from one or more audio engineers backing up that he had said the word heroin. And finally they brought me in, and I said, look, this is a classic case where it's just untranscribable. It was extremely short. It was decontextualized, as we say. It had no surrounding context to help us. And definitely you couldn't uphold that it was saying the word heroin. And frankly, to tell the truth, now that I've listened to a lot of audio recordings, drug dealers very seldom use the word heroin anyway, and he might have been talking about a heroine in a movie. There was just nothing to really uphold the fact that he had said the word heroin in that case. So it would have been much better if that had been discovered right from the beginning, rather than having a lot of disputes and arguments in front of the court at that time.
I understand that in a lot of these cases you have police officers or intelligence officers go into the witness box and say, look, I've been listening to hundreds of hours of these covertly recorded conversations. I'm very familiar with the voice, and although you can't necessarily make out the words, I can tell you, because I'm familiar with the voices, what they're saying.
Well, yes, this is the system that is called, I believe, using police as ad hoc experts. And this means they're not true experts, but they're experts for the sake of the particular case. In other words, they've often listened to many hours of the voices of the people involved in the case, and they have a strong sense that they now know those voices and they can hear what the people are saying even when other people can't hear them. And unfortunately, this appears to be given some support by our legal system. And I must say, from the point of view of, again, not just me, but most phonetics experts would strongly agree, that really just doesn't make sense at all. Being familiar with a voice may or may not, to some extent, help you hear what people are saying under some circumstances, but it certainly doesn't make you an expert in what they are saying in particular cases. And it seems very clear to me that to the extent that police can hear that kind of degraded audio more clearly than somebody else, what they're actually using is their knowledge of the context of the case, not their knowledge of the speaker's voices.
And presumably police officers, subconsciously, they want to get that piece of evidence which will support the prosecution. So they're listening out for it and subconsciously want to hear it.
Well, I want to be really, really clear on one important point here, Damien, and that's that by no means am I accusing the police of being biased or using any means they can to nab somebody for a case or something like that. I've worked with police over many years in this topic of forensic transcription and forensic phonetics more generally, and I certainly don't have the sense that they are generally biased or taking shortcuts or any of those things. As we've just seen in discussing our experiment, it's really human nature to be primed by your expectations when it comes to speech. When we listen to each other speaking, part of what we hear comes what we call bottom-up from the speech wave, but an enormous amount of what we hear comes, as we say, top-down from our expectations about what we're going to hear. That's just the way that speech perception works. And I myself heard I shot the prick when it was primed, when I was primed with it. It's not the case that we won't hear that. It is the case that we will not accept that as evidence that that's what he said. The fact that we hear it is a piece of evidence that we then have to check up much more carefully as to what that is, in fact, what he just said. And my worry about the use of ad hoc experts in this way in the legal system at the moment is that it encourages police to put faith in what they hear with their own ears in these kinds of recordings, as opposed to taking a critical stance to what they hear with their own ears, and where necessary, bringing in an expert to evaluate how they are transcribing the material.
Phonetics expert Dr. Helen Fraser. That's the Law Report for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks to producer Erica Vowles and technical producer Melissa May. Do visit our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. There you can download audio, listen to the program online, read a transcript or leave a comment. There's also at our site a link to Helen Fraser's website, and you can send your unprimed friends to her site where they can sit the test for themselves. I've directed several friends and family to the site, and their responses have been fascinating.